Welcome back to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. 76 billion. That's how many opioid pain pills flooded the country between 2006 and 2012. You might guess that this was the work of scores of pharmaceutical companies and distributors, but according to a three-year investigation by the Washington Post, that number is actually much smaller. Nearly 75% of the pills were distributed by just six companies. Those companies are named in a massive, groundbreaking civil action case. The Washington Post has been covering that case and the crisis at large for these past 3 years. Joining me now in the studio to talk about the reporting is investigative reporter with the Washington Post, Scott Higham. Scott, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Scott, you and your team have spent 3 years, as I mentioned, investigating the country's opioid crisis between 2006 to 2012. What was going on during that eight-year period? Give me a sense of the scale of the crisis and how it was being fed.
Well, you know, so far we have about 200,000 people who have died from prescription drugs alone in this country. And so that's more than the Vietnam War, Afghanistan, and Iraq combined U.S. military personnel lost during that time. And so we've always wondered why there were so many pills on the streets of America. We began investigating this, as you said, 3 years ago in 2016. We filed FOIAs with the DEA, asking them for access to a database that they maintain. It tracks the path of every single prescription, a controlled substance in the United States. They denied us access. We still continued to investigate the culpability and of the companies that were involved in this. And we had a lot of sources within the DEA who were pointing us in the right direction. Just recently, about a year ago, we filed a lawsuit asking for access to this database. It's the center of a case in Cleveland where 2,000 lawsuits are pending by towns, counties, and cities that are suing the industry for the damage that has been done to their communities by these drugs.
Now, there are so many parts of this opioid epidemic. There's heroin, there's prescription fentanyl, there are other drugs as well. But you focused on these legal prescription drugs. People have heard of them, OxyContin, oxycodone, other similar drugs that do have legitimate uses in the medical community. These are legitimate pain medications that get sidetracked and used for illegitimate purposes or people who simply have become addicted. How exactly were so many pain pills allowed, or I shouldn't say allowed to, that's passive, pushed into American communities? What was the path? How did this work?
Well, you know, it began with OxyContin, which was a drug that was manufactured by Purdue Pharma. It was marketed as being less addictive, as being safe for all kinds of pain, migraines, backaches, sports injuries. That turned out not to be true. It was one of the most highly addictive drugs ever manufactured. Purdue Pharma lost the patent on that drug in 2004, and generic manufacturers stepped into the market and began manufacturing millions and millions of these pills. And they started getting shipped all across the country. The nation became addicted to these drugs. And these companies are supposed to have a responsibility to maintain effective controls over these narcotics. The allegations are that they did not maintain effective controls over these drugs, and they started spilling onto the streets. They went through pill mills. You could buy them over the internet. The country was awash in them. And we never really knew how many pills were on the street until just recently, until we gained access to this database. And we won this lawsuit. And like you said, 76 billion pills in 7 years. And that's only between 2006 and 2012. We don't have the data to 2019. And we're still fighting for that data. But that's a glimpse inside this world that we didn't have before.
76 billion tablets. And another number that's astounding is 380 million transactions with opioid pain pills within that same period. 380 million times somebody went to a counter with a prescription, either legitimate or fraudulent or manufactured for them, to get their hands on opioids. Is there a way to compare this crisis with what that would have been with the legitimate medical need for these opioids? They do have medical use. Doctors do prescribe them legitimately. How do we get our heads around how much bigger that 380 million number is than what it might have been if in the ideal world, these drugs were being used properly.
Right. It's pretty hard to figure that out, but yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that there are people who are in legitimate pain and they need these medications. And so it's important that those people get these medications, but it's also important to make sure that these drugs don't go onto the black market. And just to give you a sense, I mean, the sheer numbers of pills would show you that there's not a medical need in some of these places. So we have places like Norton, Virginia. It's a little tiny town in Southern Virginia where there was enough drugs dispensed and distributed to that little town that it was enough for 306 pills per person. And that just doesn't seem to be a medical need. It's every baby, child, man, woman in that town. Martinsville, Virginia, 242 pills per person. Mingo County, West Virginia, 205 pills per person. Some of these towns were getting millions and millions of pills, and there were only 4,000 people living there. And so you look at that and you say, is there a medical necessity for those pills? Even one of the top DEA people in the deposition that just came out, a lot of documents are starting to come out now that were sealed. We also fought to get those unsealed. He was asked, is there any medical need for that kind of, those kinds of numbers going into these little tiny towns? And he said, absolutely not. There's no medical need.
So tell me a little bit more about this massive civil action lawsuit. I mean, it's a complex web that gets these drugs into American communities. They're the people who make them, the Purdue farmers of the world, big pharma. There are pharmacies, there are distributors, there are doctors. How does the civil action lawsuit approach these different buckets of people?
Well, it's approaching this as prosecutors would approach an organized crime ring or a drug cartel. They are proceeding under civil RICO charges, or racketeering charges. They're alleging that these companies work together to protect themselves from enforcement actions. You mentioned, Todd, that Purdue Pharma is one of the companies that is in the imagination of the American public. But what these numbers show is that Purdue Pharma has not really been in this game for a very, very long time. You know, the really big companies are companies that most Americans have never heard of. They're companies like Mallinckrodt, and they have a subsidiary called SpecGX. I mean, that company alone had distributed 28 billion pills, manufactured 28 billion pills during that time. Another company called Activist, 26 billion pills. Another company called Par, 12 billion pills. So those are the big manufacturers. Purdue Pharma had a very, very small part of the market. They got hit with a huge civil fine. They were prosecuted criminally for false marketing a while ago.
2007.
So they started kind of, fading into the past, and these other companies stepped into the market.
You know, I'm not a prosecutor, but in so many ways, this sounds like the big tobacco lawsuit, the tobacco fights of the 80s, 90s, and the tobacco settlement from states that followed. Manufacturing these billions of pills from otherwise small companies, you ask the question, they had to have known. Yes, they're making money hand over fist. That's business. They knew, right? This must allege they knew this was not medical need and they turned it out anyway.
Well, I mean, the allegations are this is their data that they provided to the DEA. This is their own sales data. This is nobody else's data. So they did know how many pills they were manufacturing. They knew how many they were distributing. They knew where those pills were going day by day, month by month, year by year. So to say they didn't know is just not accurate. Absolutely knew.
Is the big tobacco settlement a way to think about this? Is it similar in scope and in action where cities, counties, and states are joining together against this industry? I mean, in that settlement, they said, you knowingly poisoned people with cigarettes for decades. Now you have to be responsible. Is it similar in that way?
It's definitely similar. This is the tobacco of the 21st century. It's in some ways it's larger, broader in its scale and its scope. In the tobacco cases, you had state AGs around the country suing the industry. In this case, you have, I think, 40 some odd state AGs who are suing separately. But then you've got 2,000 towns and cities and counties that are suing, alleging that that these companies destroyed their communities. And if you go out to places like Ohio or West Virginia or Pennsylvania, and you go into some of these places where the pills were just flooding into these communities, it's like zombie land. I mean, people are overdosing in public parks and sidewalks in their cars. It's just a really heartbreaking scene. seen in a lot of American towns and cities.
You focus on many of these places you just mentioned in your reporting with your colleagues. Talk about Ohio a little bit. They're critical to this case. It's a state that's been devastated by this crisis. Take us inside a little bit, a typical Ohio community, and why the state of Ohio and its governor and the decision makers there are so intent on this.
Well, you know, we just, my partner Sari Horowitz and I just not too long ago went into a little tiny town in southern Ohio. And the pill epidemic led to the heroin epidemic because pills started getting harder to get. Now it's a fentanyl epidemic. These towns are so hard hit that there's a little jail there that was built in the 1800s that has basically become the detox center. And so there's no place for treatment. There's no place for help. There are people who are just stumbling around the streets. It's just kind of epic. And so this lawsuit in Cleveland, if it does go to trial, it's going to focus on two counties, Summit and Cuyahoga County up by Cleveland. And those two towns, those two counties allege that this industry has just decimated those two counties. Babies born addicted, police working overtime, their jobs rather than law enforcement is helping people who are overdosing. Hospitals that are overrun. The strain on public health services is just enormous. And so that is going to be the first test of this case.
I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. You point out in your reporting that there is no corner of America completely left untouched by the opioid epidemic. But some places, when you look at the map of distribution, are just much more dark purple than other places around America. Many of those places, as you mentioned, are in southern Ohio. Some are in southern Virginia. Some are in Oklahoma. Many are in Appalachia. And your reporting at the Post, your colleagues took you to a town called Abington in Virginia with residents who've struggled with opioid addiction, and they're working toward recovery. Here's one of the people that you talked to.
People have lost their brothers, their mothers, their fathers, their grandparents. You've lost family members. I mean, it's been going on for 20 years or longer, you know, and it's just a daggone shame that it has to come to this for all these people to die before they start even looking into it, you know. How could you sleep? That's what I'd ask them. I mean, how can you sleep at night knowing that you just helped push all these thousands and millions of pills to people and destroy lives?
What could you actually say to somebody who obviously doesn't care?
There you go.
The only thing you could really do is step up and try to get something started to have them be held accountable for what they've done.
Scott Heim, the voices of regular Americans devastated by the opioid epidemic, it sounds like in their own families and in their own towns. One of them asks, what are you supposed to do in the face of someone who doesn't care? Sure, a pharmaceutical corporation or a distributor in some other state that has profit motive. But Ms. Bautista tweets this: what does the connection between doctors and pharmaceutical companies look like in these smaller towns and communities? What about the physicians? What about the physicians who were writing the prescriptions? You're not supposed to be able to get OxyContin or related drugs without a prescription. Somebody was writing those.
Right, and that's where the epidemic began, with doctors overprescribing, and with doctors who were corrupt and were prescribing for money. And that began mostly in Florida with pill mills. It began on internet pharmacies. I think that the kind of shady medical community saw an opportunity to make a lot of money, but then there were no questions asked all the way up the line. And you know, in this supply chain, it needs to be highly regulated, but it's also self-regulated. So the doctors need to pay attention, the pharmacies need to pay attention, the distributors need to pay attention, and the manufacturers all the way up the line. And if somebody is not doing their job, then pills start hitting the street. And that's what we saw. You see people camping out in the parking lots of pharmacies, waiting for them to open, doing drugs in the parking lot. Coming in with out-of-state license plates, out-of-state tags, It was very clear in a lot of these places that these people were not pain patients. They were drug addicts. They were drug dealers. They were there just to get the drugs, and they were dispensed, nevertheless, with no questions asked.
We'd love to hear from you as well, 1A listeners. What questions do you have for Scott? Please share what you know about the pharmaceutical company's role in the opioid crisis, or your doctor, or the pharmacy down the street. You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A. As always, our email address is 1A@WAMU.org. Scott Heim, you mentioned the role of doctors prescribing irresponsibly. At an earlier point in my career, I was a medical and science reporter, and I sat through many presentations as a younger reporter where doctors doing research with research money from pharmaceutical companies would send this message to doctors: pain is real. If you're not treating pain properly, you're not a good doctor. Don't ignore your patient's pain because that's 1950s medicine. If you're modern and you're a forward-thinking doctor, you treat pain, and we have just the drugs to do it. Doctors were shamed over and over and over, not to be fraudulent or dishonest. They were shamed: if you're a good doctor, you use these drugs because pain is real.
Well, one of the things that's starting to come out is why those doctors were told those things. And a lot of that was funded by the industry. There were doctors, there were key opinion leaders who were paid by the industry to spread that message. There were pain groups that said that they were advocating for patients' rights when they were actually being funded by Purdue Pharma and lots of other companies. So a lot of this is starting to come to light. It came to light before this lawsuit. More things are coming out in this lawsuit. And we're starting to see how that message was communicated to doctors. They were basically told, these drugs are safe, it's okay. Pain is just is something that you need to treat. It is real. And these drugs can be managed and that people will not be addicted. And that was not the truth. Mm.
Well, part of that is true. Pain is real. It does need to be managed. And even I witnessed how that truth, that pain is real and needs to be managed, really was twisted in a very sophisticated psychological way. With the other part that you mentioned, which was not true. These drugs are safe. These drugs are easy to manage. That was never true.
That's the part that's false.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so many doctors were led in those times into what might have been freewheeling use of opioids. Emmy tweets, what big pharma executives will go to jail for this death and destruction they've caused around America? Well, that may be one of the questions maybe to the side of this civil action lawsuit, not a criminal lawsuit. Should Big Pharma be compensating the hundreds of thousands of families who've lost loved ones to this opioid addiction? We'll talk about what victims might be owed right after the break. I'm speaking with Scott Heim, Washington Post investigative reporter, about the paper's extensive 3-year investigation into the opioid crisis across America. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. Stay close. This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Who should be held accountable for the opioid crisis and its continuing human consequences? We're talking companies and accountability with Washington Post investigative reporter Scott Heim, and we'd love to hear from you as well. Share what you know about the pharmaceutical company's role in the opioid crisis, and doctors for that matter, too. You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A. Our email address, 1A@WAMU.org. Lane tweets this: did the doctors not educate their patients regarding the possibility of addiction? That message was preached loudly and clearly to me in the 90s about other prescription medications. Scott Heim, what about the proper management of these medications when doctors were freely and openly prescribing opioids? Were they also being told to manage them carefully, or was it the Wild West?
It was the Wild West. It's kind of like the cocaine cowboy days of South Florida of the 80s, except for, this is the oxy and hydrocodone days of the 1990s and 2000s. Once these pills start hitting the street, onto the black market and people started abusing them, there was no turning back. And there were a lot of pill mills out there that were nothing more than just fronts for criminal organizations and drug dealing operations. And nobody was shutting them down. Nobody was paying attention. And when the DEA finally started cracking down on them in the mid-2000s, they realized, like, you can't arrest doctors all day long. You can't close down pill mills all day. You're just playing a game of whack-a-mole. You have to start going up the food chain. Why are all these pills going downstream? Who's responsible upstream? Why are the distributors sending millions and millions of pills to tiny little communities? Why are millions and millions of pills going to one single pharmacy? Why is one pharmacy 1 month ordering 10 million doses of oxycodone, 10,000 doses of oxycodone, and the next month they're ordering 20,000, 30,000, 40,000? What's going on?
In the same community.
In the same pharmacy.
Right.
So the DEA started cracking down, and they started making cases against companies like CVS, Walgreens, Walmart, McKesson, Cardinal, some of the biggest names in the drug industry, and those companies started fighting back, and they went after the DEA and tried to shut down the DEA's enforcement actions.
Pushback and blowback. Now, those companies are distributors and sellers, not manufacturers. Immediately, you get this political pushback on the government. Don't interfere with our businesses. And it reminds me of when the DEA would monitor doctors for their prescribing habits. You would get the American Medical Association pushing back. Don't look over doctors' shoulders. Don't regulate the practice of medicine. You're coming between me and my patient. It sounds very similar.
Yes, it is absolutely similar. And then, you know, this is like a roadmap to the epidemic. This database shows you exactly who knew what, when they knew it, and it starts at the very top with the manufacturers, because they know exactly how many pills they're making and which distributors they're going to. And the distributors know exactly how many pills they have and which pharmacies they're sending it to. And the distributors know where all those pills are going all across the country, day by day, minute by minute. So there's a very clear view that these companies had on where the pills were going.
But that's one of the things that struck me hardest about your work, Scott, and it's that DEA database was so good and so detailed and so granular. They knew where every pill was going, and that just leads you to the question, how could this happen, right? If the DEA is watching, how did so many pills in so many communities get pushed and pushed and pushed for so long? A year or two, political blowback, I get it. We're talking about a decade as, frankly, as the bodies stack up. And you had the database to know where the pills were going, and that just makes you ask, how could this happen when they had the information?
Well, this database, it's called ARCOS. This database was such a mess when it got into the hands of the attorneys that nobody could make heads or tails of it. It was antiquated. There were no. It was not updated at all. And the prescription pill world is monitored by a very small group of men and women in the DEA. They're a backwater operation. There's not many of them. They're looked down upon by the agency, and they were not given the resources to do their job. There was lots and lots of cases and not a lot of agents and not a lot of money. And that database was such a mess that nobody could really make heads or tails of it. In fact, the defense and the plaintiffs in this case had to hire outside, you know, PhD computer specialists to go through the database and figure out what does it mean and put it in shape so they can actually read it.
Skip tweets us this: as much as it seems related to the big tobacco process that I mentioned from the 1990s, it's also similar to the financial crisis of 2008, where a highly regulated industry looked the other way and failures up and down the line led to a crisis that grew to massive proportions, fueled largely by profit motive. There may be a similarity there, Scott Higham, but what's at stake here for the companies if found culpable in this massive suit? What do they stand to lose?
Billions and billions of dollars, reputation. You know, there's a lot at stake here. There are so many lawyers representing these companies. When you go online, it will take you, like 5 minutes to scroll through the numbers of lawyers who are representing these companies. The stakes have never been higher for these firms. Their stock price, their futures, their compensation, everything that, that these companies rely upon is at stake.
Well, as we go back further in history, we've talked about how doctors were instructed or maybe shamed to prescribe these drugs, how companies and distributors flooded small communities with thousands, hundreds of thousands, or billions of pills. But you mentioned Purdue Pharma at the top and how they were fined in 2007. That fine was massive. It was $600 million, and it was a criminal fine. It was the biggest, I think, in corporate American history, a criminal fine for marketing OxyContin illegally. That seems to me like another red flag. Back in 2007, a big fine, maybe a cost of doing business for a company like Purdue Pharma. But again, brings me back to the same question. If you knew big companies were marketing these drugs illegally, that's 2007. Here we are in 2019. It only got worse.
Absolutely. And, you know, that was a fine for false marketing. And then what these other companies did, the generic companies that started coming in behind Purdue Pharma, they weren't marketing their drugs. They were just continuing to send them down the pipeline. And so it's a whole new stream that people were not paying attention to. And these companies have a responsibility under the Controlled Substance Act to maintain effective controls over their drugs. And the allegations are that they were not maintaining effective controls. In fact, they were doing quite the opposite.
Now, what do the companies say so far in their own defense? Let's take the distributors and the sellers that you mentioned. They will mount a defense here. What do they say about their role?
Well, they blame the doctors, obviously. They also say that they were, you know, doing the best that they can. They also blame the DEA for not doing more. They say that it's almost impossible for these plaintiffs to say that their drugs caused all these deaths, specifically caused deaths. So they have a number of defenses that they're raising.
I want to bring it back down to the level of the patient, because your reporting does that too. It talks about the law, it talks about the big companies, and also about the people in communities across America. And a lot of people have been reaching out to us. Carrie tweets, I went to a pain management clinic a few years ago when he prescribed tramadol. The doctor said, tramadol taken 3 times a day. And I interrupted, I have to take this 3 times a day. And he said, no, a maximum of 3 a day, 3 tablets. Wording was dangerous. If a patient hears take 3 times a day, they could be set on a path to over-medication and addiction. And that's a specific case, but I think it goes to the issue of management of these drugs. I would assume, I would want to think that now, after the crisis has gotten so bad, that many more doctors are more careful, more serious, and take more time with their patients, or are they?
Oh, absolutely. I was sitting next to somebody and telling them about how my son had his wisdom teeth taken out recently, and he was prescribed 22 oxycodone tablets, which I thought was outrageous. And there was a guy sitting behind me who was in dental school, and he said, you know, I couldn't help but overhear, but, you know, now we're being told no more than like 4 or 5 tablets for oral surgery. And so I think doctors are getting the message that this is a big problem. Look, people are in pain. You break an arm or a leg, or you have, you know, serious oral surgery or you know, heart surgery. You need something to kill the pain. But do you need, you know, 22 oxycodone because you had your wisdom teeth taken out? Probably not.
Yet, as Ann tweets, my husband had 2 shoulder surgeries in 2 years in Alabama. He was given huge supplies of opioids, no questions asked, no warning signs given, either time. Now, I don't know when that was, Anne, but that's the counterexample to what you're describing.
Right. Well, today, it would just be irresponsible, I think, for doctors to do that.
And have professional standards changed in the doctors' accrediting bodies or their professional manuals on how to manage opioids? Has the medical profession learned substantial lessons that are codified about how to treat these drugs?
I don't know if they're codified, but in med schools now, I think the students are getting the message, do not overprescribe. These are dangerous, dangerous pills. For some people, they won't get addicted at all. Other people might get sick taking these pills. But a lot of people get addicted very, very quickly, and it doesn't take very much at all. I had surgery earlier this year and was given fentanyl while I was in the hospital at Hopkins. And I was on it for 2 days, and when I came home, I went through withdrawals. It was only like 20 minutes, but, you know, that's how powerful these drugs are. Mm-hmm. So it's really critical that doctors pay attention and do not overprescribe.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. A couple of people have written us about how healthcare is accredited and given that good housekeeping seal of approval. Teresa tweets, to what extent do accreditation bodies like the Joint Commission, which is a hospital accreditation body, and its push for pain control as a required part of safe patient care contribute to the opioid crisis? We got another tweet as well from Katrina. Patient satisfaction scores for hospitals and doctors are also related to how well they control patient pain. Both of those suggesting that those things may cause doctors and hospitals to want to treat pain more, maybe get reckless.
Well, the fascinating thing about that is that the industry was behind a lot of that that kind of marketing within the medical community, that pain is the fifth vital sign, came from a push from the industry. And you know, those little faces, you know, what's your level of pain? A lot of that was pushed by the industry. And so, and the doctors believed it, and they don't want their patients complaining. They don't want their patients going to other doctors. And so,
and they don't want bad accreditation scores if you're the dean of a hospital.
Exactly. Yes. So there's blame all the way down the line.
What's the other side of that, though? Every time we have this discussion, you don't want to get away from the idea that pain is real. Pain should be managed. Those ideas that you need to manage pain aren't wrong at their base. If they're pushed for a profit motive to open up a pipeline for a multi-billion-dollar company, they're wrong. But the medical basis isn't wrong. Do we risk a backlash of hospitals and doctors? Now, I don't want the DEA on my back. I don't want lawsuit. I don't want my patient, frankly, being addicted to opioids in the first instance. Is there a backlash risk here in medicine?
Well, there already is, and the pendulum is swung now entirely in the other direction. And you know, we're hearing from a lot of people saying, "I can't get my pain medication, and I'm in serious pain." And so that is a problem. I mean, a lot of people do have legitimate pain needs, and those needs need to be met. And so, you know, that's a critical area.
Your investigation is already resulting in some change. In an interview with the Washington Post, Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring listed a few ways where he hoped big pharmaceutical companies will be held accountable in the long term. Let's listen.
These companies flooded America with billions of pills. They developed elaborate schemes to sell more and more pills with sales incentives, with marketing strategies. They often used deception and lies to get doctors to prescribe more and more pills. I want the lies to stop. People need to know the truth about these drugs. I want to hold the people responsible for what they've done. I want to try to get those who are responsible to pay for the treatment and recovery that so many families and communities around our Commonwealth need.
There's a message from Mark Herring, the Attorney General of Virginia. What early response to your reporting so far, Scott?
Well, it's been overwhelming. This database, when it was unsealed by the judge's order, Stephen Rich, who is our database editor, went through it, got it in really good shape, and started to do these data runs. And what the Washington Post has done is opened up this data for the public. Anybody can go onto our website and they can see how many pills came into their community, who shipped them, who manufactured them, and who dispensed them. And so news organizations across the country, big and small, are using that data to do their own stories. Citizens are looking at this data to see what happened. You know, we're a lot of these places, Todd, like Ohio, you mentioned, there is no degree of separation between these pills and a death. Everywhere you go, somebody knows somebody, and a lot of times it's in their immediate family. And if they don't know somebody, they know somebody who knows somebody who has died. And so we have opened up that database as a public service so that anybody can go on and take a look, and the response has been overwhelming.
John tweets, the large-scale distribution of opioid-based pain medicine well beyond any medical need was a crime against humanity. The people responsible for this should be treated accordingly. Scott, we got to go, but what are the next steps in this big lawsuit? Where does it stand? What's the timeline?
Well, a lot of company documents are starting to come out, so you're starting to see what the thinking was inside these companies during the height of the epidemic. And now they're gearing up for a trial in October, and there are rumblings that there may be criminal investigations ahead.
so much to watch for in this big investigation, civil action lawsuit at several levels of the opioid crisis, from distributors and pharmaceutical companies to pharmacies in communities all across America. I've been speaking with Washington Post investigative reporter Scott Higham. Scott, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Todd.
And I want to encourage all of you, if you haven't been on the Washington Post's website, to see not only the reporting, but the presentation of the DEA's database, the maps, illustrating the breadth and the depth of the opioid crisis in this country. It's well worth your time. Remember, you can subscribe to 1A's podcast on the NPR One app or whatever app you'd like. We'd love it if you'd rate us, write us a review. You can find the news roundup in your podcast feed tomorrow afternoon. You'll find all the links to listen online at npr.org/1A. This program was produced by Stacia Brown. To learn more about her and the rest of the great 1A staff, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. This is 1A.